from the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. This is the Closing Market Report. It is the 10th day of May, 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Kurt Kimmel. He's the Senior Grains Analyst at Bates Commodities in Normal, Illinois. And later in the half hour, we'll discuss the cash grain market with the folks at the Andersons right here in Champaign County. Today, we'll hear Daryl Good's perspective on the recent purchases of corn by the Chinese. Find out how soft red winter wheat producers can assess the value of keeping or tearing up the crop in favor of something else, and learn a bit more about Pioneer's announcement last week that U.S. EPA had finally approved its Optimum Acre Max technology, at least for this season. And then, in the second half hour of our program today, on many of these stations and always online at willag.org, we'll talk with NCGA's Rob Elliott. And don't forget, in just 26 minutes, we'll check in with the folks at Chesapeake Energy to discuss the global agricultural weather forecast right here on this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media from the University of Illinois.
The Closing Market Report is made possible in part by a grant from Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois, a full-service commodities firm with two toll-free lines. In Illinois, 800-252-2013. In Indiana, 800-637-3123. Or email to Cooley at admworld.com.
In Chicago, on this Monday afternoon, futures finished with the nearby contracts in the wheat pit much lower. May contract to 482.5, settlement price down 17.75. July 492.75, 17.75 lower. In September, wheat 509.5, down 17 cents. May Kansas City wheat at 501, 11.5 lower. The July there down 13 cents. May corn futures $3.63, 1.75 lower. July at 370.5, down 1.5. September 377.75, 3/4 lower. In December corn, $3.86.5, up 0.5 cent. The March contract at 399.25, up 0.25 cent. May soybean futures 952.75, 1.5 higher today. July at 961, up 1. August 957.75, 1.5 higher. In September futures 942.75, up 0.01 on the afternoon. November beans 934.75, up 0.5 cent. May bean meal 278.20, up $1.80. July futures at 278.70, 30 cents higher. May soybean oil 38.10, down 3 cents. July down a nickel at 38.39. Live cattle futures, June contract 96.70, up 80 cents. The August futures at 95.07.5, 87.5 higher. And the May lean hogs at 88.60, up a dime for the day. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures, June contract, $77.16, $2.05 higher for the day. June ethanol at $1.62.07, unchanged. Natural gas at $4.17.04, up 15.9 of a cent. Heating oil at $2.12.7, up 4.7. And gold futures at $1,200.40, down $9.60 an ounce today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average at 10,738, just about 358 points higher on the afternoon. And the Goldman Sachs at 515.61 is 12.14 higher for the day. Here's what the weather forecast for the two-state region looks like as it comes from our own Mike Sola. He says tonight, mostly cloudy, some showers, thunderstorms. Lows will range from 45 in northeastern Indiana to 60 in the far south. And then tomorrow in Illinois, mostly cloudy skies, showers mainly before the noon hour. In Indiana, cloudy, scattered showers, some thunderstorms. Highs will range from 52 in far northwestern Illinois to 82 in the far southern part of Illinois. The unseasonable cold of the past weekend, he says, will give way to some warming temperatures and a more active weather pattern. Rain will cover all of the two-state area at some various times this week. The heaviest rainfall expected to be distributed across the far north, with some minor flooding potential developing in northwestern Illinois through midweek. Southwestern Illinois could also see heavy rainfall with flooding in low-lying fields and river basins, as well as potentially severe storms toward the middle of the week. Topsoil, of course, will benefit from the moisture recharge this week. The driest areas are right now in central and eastern Indiana and eastern Illinois. Subsoil moistures should remain adequate for most areas. More on the agricultural weather forecast when we get to the bottom of this half hour.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Doug Slayton in Galesburg at 309-341-5003. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report from Illinois Public Media. It is a Monday afternoon, time to check in on the agricultural futures markets. Kurt Kimmel of Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois, is with us today, as he is each and every Monday afternoon. Good afternoon to you, Kurt.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Hey, what a turnaround things have had. And we'll start with the Dow, because it was up, well, up about 360 points at the hour of this broadcast. Quite the run there, and I suppose crude oil up a couple of bucks for the afternoon. Things turning around, and why is that the case?
Well, the market live and dies by news, and any type of bullish news, they overdo to the upside. Any type of bearish news seem they do to the downside. But there was great concerns about Europe, especially Greece, and it was pretty well done for the European Union and the euro currency going home Friday. But over the weekend, they've hammered out a deal where over $1 trillion of funds are going to be available. Good chunk of it from the EU, a portion of it from the IMF to keep that country afloat. So we sort of came to a head here where they did step in and gave the market some confidence here. So instead of the sky falling, it's probably just a low overcast type of report. So we'll see how the next few days go, and the ability of the country to hold together here gave the market some confidence that it was not the end of the world. And so we found buyers over the weekend and first thing this morning to come in and give the stock market energies. Some of these markets got hammered late last week, support, and saw the decoupling take place of people coming back out of the safe haven gold and reinvesting in some of the other marketplaces, Todd.
Not the end of the world there, but in Chicago for the soft red winter wheat pit, it was kind of a rough day. They're low, very low at this point, and they just continued downward. Was that because they showed such a big crop in Oklahoma last week, or other things?
Well, I think it was a combination of things. It seems the Chicago wheat, the July particularly, rallies up above $5, runs out of steam, and breaks down into the it's 460, 470 area. There's anticipation that the wheat coming out with dormancy, the cold weekend forecast, there could be some frost freeze damage take place. That gave us bullish news towards the end of last week. Also, too, if we do have problems in Europe, that maybe U.S. could benefit from some additional demand. Also, too, for the first time, I think, really, we saw the trade buy grain futures as a safe haven, knowing that you can't eat gold or drink crude oil. So I think we saw some investment money come in to that market, too, late last week. And then as we got through the weekend, not that much damage, some problem solving in Europe and ideas that maybe the demand might not be there, put the trade on the defensive. And above all, two, the trade's going to be looking at tomorrow morning's USDA numbers, domestic numbers, world numbers, and we're still going to be in a position where we've got plenty of wheat domestically and worldwide. So we've taken some premium out of the wheat market, and we'll see what tomorrow brings here and see what type of correction we get as we start to see some, actually, some early harvest activity start to come forward here as we move into late month.
Yeah, the world agricultural supply and demand estimates are out tomorrow morning. The average trade guess now for corn is a 1.853 billion bushel carryover. USDA in April at 1.899. So they're optimistic that a bit more has gone out the door. I suppose that maybe is the Chinese export marketplace. And then on soybeans, they're looking at 182 million, comparatively speaking, to 190 million. Those numbers within range of what you're thinking about?
Yeah, I think we could shave a few more bushels off. On the Chinese, if you take 1 million metric tons, 40 million bushels, You could see that being quite optimistic. And also, too, you got to maybe cut back on the ending stocks due to maybe a little increase in feed demand and a little increase in ethanol. So we've got room to come back down. But a 1.85, a 1.8 still signals we got plenty of supplies around. So we'll see what their outlook is, and more importantly, see what the trade reaction is from those numbers tomorrow morning.
How long will they trade it?
Well, they'll trade it for about 5 minutes, because that's what the world grain traders are watching, is the five-minute bar chart. It's amazing how the news comes in and out of the market, and the attitude changes in a matter of just 5 or 10 minutes. But we'll get those numbers digested, then start to look at the longer-term weather pattern, see if there's any more Chinese news.
Anything else in those reports we ought to be aware of for tomorrow morning?
We'll have the first sort of solid 2010 estimates. The bottom line on the corn will be 1884 as the trade average. Beans, 338 million bushel carryout, and wheat, about 961 million bushel. So those will be important numbers, too. And other things that do come out is the livestock side equation, meat exports. So we'll continue to kind of watch that, see if we continue to see the trend pointed northward on our beef and pork exports to Asia.
Yeah, so USDA's first real look, and it always comes in the May WASD numbers at the following year, or the current year, I guess, the following marketing year, this harvest, what's being put in the ground now. And what the carryout might be, not this fall, but the following fall. That 330 is a pretty good-sized number for soybeans. Is it going to, everybody knows it's there. Is it going to put any real pressure on the marketplace when they see it?
Well, I think it's just going to be a confirmation it's there. If we go back in history, we've had, especially when old Willard Sparks was head to the helm there, we saw that group put out some 400, 500 million bushel carryout estimates at the beginning of the marketing year. And time we got through the marketing year, it was much lower, down into the 200, 180 million bushel area. So we'll take those numbers, and those traders will put those numbers on the supply-demand balance sheet. Then they'll add or subtract yield to that, and they'll add, subtract demand to that to come up with their estimate of the bottom line, and it's going to change dramatically between now and a year from this September.
Kurt, we appreciate you taking the time with us today.
Very good. Take care.
You too. Kurt Campbell is with Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois, joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Monday afternoon.
Learned Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learned Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learned Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. Last week, U.S. EPA granted Pioneer, it's a DuPont business, a temporary approval for its refuge in a bag concept. I'll have more on the registration and what it could mean for corn farmers in the United States. May the 3rd, U.S. EPA announced it had granted temporary approval of Optimum AcreMax 1 insect protection for Pioneer brand corn hybrids. This marks the EPA's first approval of an in-the-bag solution for insect refuge management. However, as Pioneer's Bill Niebuhr explains, it's a temporary approval that ends September the 30th of this year.
The original registration comes out right now, and then what we do is we go back up for review in September, and we share with the EPA the experiences that we've had and the data that we've collected from this summer's extensive field testing. And so what we were able to do is to get the actual go-ahead and green light on the AcreMax technology. We're putting it out in the field in our white bag program. We have it out with a number of growers. We're going to collect that information and bring that back to the registration officials just to give them, in the most transparent way possible, the opportunity to see how well this technology works and the insect counts and the various other field observations that we have for the product.
So Pioneer still has some hurdles to manage before the optimum AcreMax 1 refuge in a bag concept really makes it into the farmer's field. The concept, the idea of non-BT GMO seed in with BT seed, has been bantered around the industry for quite a while. It's not used yet, says extension entomologist Mike Gray.
It's an approach to manage corn rootworms in such a way that resistance to BT hybrids can either be delayed or prevented. And of course, the current strategy has been to utilize a structured refuge. Growers putting out either strips of non-BT seed or separate blocks of non-BT seed. And so this recent approval by EPA really is a significant departure from where we've been with the structured refuges for BT hybrids.
An approach that's really quite different. The current regulations require a farmer to set aside a block of land planted to non-BT corn adjacent or stripped into a field equal to 20% of the area, unless it's a SmartStax hybrid, in which case the structured refuge can be as little as 5%. U.S. EPA approved a 10% non-BT blend for Pioneer's refuge in a bag. Mike Gray thinks this presents some solutions farmers will really like, not having to plant a refuge, and some problems they'll really dislike.
Well, because the corn rootworm refuge is going to be a mixture of seeds out in a field, and this will take place at planting. There's no separate block. There's no separate strip or field perimeter. In other words, you're going to have plants within that field, some expressing the BT protein in the root system, others not. And so if you did have a very significant infestation of corn rootworms and the non-BT expressing plants began to suffer, significant pruning, there's really nothing you can do about that during the growing season.
That's because the rescue treatments for corn rootworms are soil insecticides applied at planting. Pioneer is field testing the refuge in a bag concept this season and hopes to collect data to satisfy U.S. EPA. By the way, the original request of the agency was for a 5% non-GMO blend in the bag. If you'd like to learn a bit more from University of Illinois Extension entomologist Mike Gray about Optimum AcreMax and his viewpoint on it, you can visit the IPM website. That's the Integrated Pest Management website at ipm.illinois.edu. And then search for the bulletin. Well, up next, corn futures have rallied this spring despite the early planting season. I'll have some of the reasons for the optimism, according to University of Illinois ag economist Daryl Good. Seasonally, corn futures rally when farmers go to the field to plant. Mostly, this is because they don't have time to sell and ship corn from storage. There's a bit more optimism at hand this spring in the corn market, says University of Illinois ag economist Daryl Good.
I think in the case of corn, we have had a little more optimism on the demand side creep back into the market. The latest data on ethanol use of corn, for example, suggests that we're maybe consuming corn at a faster rate than projected by USDA. The economics of blending ethanol are very, very strong right now, so there's a very good demand for ethanol. I think the recovery in livestock prices has also created some optimism about feed demand for corn.
Feed demand that has come down despite the lower number of animals in the United States and the DDGs, a byproduct of ethanol production, that are offsetting some feed need for corn.
I think everybody feels better when the livestock producer is making money and able to buy feed, and perhaps that's going to increase the demand a bit. But probably the thing that really turned the market a bit higher was news that China bought a little bit of U.S. corn, not large quantities at this point, and not a complete surprise because they had been releasing domestic reserves and had issued import licenses a few weeks ago.
Releasing reserves suggested the Chinese were short of their own stocks of corn. The import licenses confirmed that supply problem.
The confirmation that they were in the marketplace for some corn, I think, stirred some buying interest and maybe pointed to better export demand than the USDA had projected and lower year-ending stocks. Obviously, I think on that front, we'd have to see more buying, some continued buying to get really optimistic, but I think that was a bit of a breakthrough on the demand side of the market.
Good believes the Chinese are short of corn for two possible reasons. First, it is certain the country has ramped up red meat, especially hog, production. Secondly, it may be that the size of last year's Chinese corn crop was overestimated. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Support for WILL comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks by developing dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is at stuart-peterson.com.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Monday afternoon. It comes to you from Illinois Public Media. On the line with us to take a look at what's been happening in the world of cash grain is Matt Payne of the Andersons right here in Champaign County. Good afternoon to you, Matt.
Good afternoon, Todd.
I suppose mostly the chatter at your office has been what USDA will come out with tomorrow morning for the WASDE report, not only for this year's marketing year, but the ending stocks for the 2010 crops, which are in the ground now. What do you have to say?
Well, what we've been hearing is, you know, guys are really winding down. I have not heard one person all year complain about progress, which means that everyone's way ahead of where they were last year, which everyone's happy about. Being a month and a half ahead is an amazing thing, amazing feeling. I am concerned, though, that, you know, with basically the corn crop in, beans are probably a third done regionally and throughout the Midwest, that this report will probably not be the most friendly tomorrow. A lot of guys that don't have everything sold from the 09 crop or don't have a lot of sales on for the 2010 crop should probably be concerned and be watching what this happens to, you know, kind of take advantage if we do see anything either way to have themselves in the best marketing position.
Yeah, what would be something you'd be watching for? Would it be a big change in the corn exports based off the Chinese?
We are hoping that we will see some change in that. I'm just concerned that the USDA will say we've got too much planted, we expect X amount of yield, and that could wave prices downward. But with all this newfound strength we see in the market because of China and other importers wanting U.S. corn, that is definitely something to take in consideration, and we are hoping that the latter outweighs it.
USDA won't, well, they shouldn't change, they shouldn't get an update of what plantings or intentions were, so I wouldn't think that would change very much, although they might have an idea of their early planting giving you a yield boost, I suppose.
So absolutely.
We'll find out what they have to say about that tomorrow. What are your bids for the day?
Right now, May delivery corn, 356, June, 360, fall delivery, 356, December, 366, beans, cash beans, 949, June, 951, and fall, 895.
Matt, it's always a pleasure to talk
Thanks.
With you. Hey, you have a good day. Matt Payne is with the Andersons right here in Champaign County. Joined us on a Monday afternoon to take up the cash grain market. When I return in just a couple of minutes, we'll talk with the folks at Chesapeake Energy about the agricultural weather forecast. A two-minute update now from the IPM Bulletin at the University of Illinois. Behind the limelight of the early corn planting in Illinois this spring stands a less than favorable wheat crop. The 2010 crop, as you'll hear, is one of the lowest rated crops in recent memory. It also occupies the smallest acreage since they began keeping records in 1866. I'll have more on how growers can determine if their wheat crop is still worth keeping. There are some good wheat fields in Illinois, but not very many, says Emerson Nafziger. He's an agronomist at the U of I. He says if a farmer's plan is to let a marginal wheat crop go to maturity and then to plant double crop soybeans, the risk should be considered. The risk of trading good row crop planting conditions now for a very late planting of a second crop under uncertain conditions in mid to late June. The key to assessing the value of a field of wheat is to count the number of heads per square foot. Each head, under normal growing conditions, represents about a bushel to the acre. Here's what to do if the decision is made to tear up the crop. Actively growing wheat should be relatively easy to kill with herbicides at this growth state. Nafziger advises growers to watch closely for insect larvae, like armyworms, that can hatch on the wheat plants and then move over to a newly planted crop once the wheat starts to die. Be careful to move the trash aside of the row, if possible, because it can transfer disease from one crop to the other. Nafziger says the goal is to place and cover seed in the soil without having crop residue pushed into the seed furrow, and that this might be achieved by using tillage if no-till doesn't work. In some cases, though, Nafziger says it may be more beneficial to let the killed crop dry up for a few more days, if that's the only way to get a good placement of seed of the replacement crop. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Monday afternoon. Time to check in on the agricultural weather forecast. John Davis of Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, Illinois, joins us. Good afternoon to you, John.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Looks like it's going to be a wet and, well, wet and then maybe wet again week. I suppose you had to tell me about it.
This is true. We do have numerous bands of showers that will be moving across the middle portion of the Midwest, with one coming through later on today and tonight, another one Wednesday night, Thursday, and yet another one over the weekend. So it does look like a pretty active week from a weather standpoint, with most areas getting, you know, moderate to some locally heavy rains as we go through the next 7-day time frame.
How much is the rainfall going to be, and what areas?
Well, for the kind of Illinois-Indiana region, it looks like most amounts will fall in kind of the 1 to 2 inch category on average. Now, there will be a couple of spots in some of the stronger storms that get a bit locally heavier amounts here. Wouldn't be surprised if some areas get 3 or 3.5 inches, but the general tendency will be for 1 to 2 inches during that 7-day time frame.
All right, so the crop off to a good start in the Midwest. The Delta doing all right in the Southwest, too?
Delta is doing fantastic. In fact, really all the major summer crop and winter crop areas are off to a very good start, and so that's why there's not great concern about this rain event coming up over the next week or 10-day time frame, because we have gotten off to such a good start. We're well ahead of schedule. Moisture levels are quite good. The moisture is very good for the winter wheat development, both in the plains and the Midwest, so certainly no lack of any kind of good weather scenarios out there.
Well, we're not sure why the Chinese are deciding to import some corn at this point. I suppose they're off to a start at least for their new growing season. Is it as good as what we've done here in the Midwest, or are they lagging?
No, it's the opposite. In fact, they've had a very poor start to their season up to this point. Unusually cool temperatures just until recently, and that has really set them aback. And certainly with some cool weather continuing in some of those areas, their start is not nearly as good as what we've seen here across the central U.S.
Now maybe you should take us to the Ukraine, talk about that hard winter wheat crop there that they should be getting ready to harvest in the next couple of months or so.
Yeah, had kind of some issues here from a weather standpoint across that region. It looks like from this point on, everything developmental-wise looks pretty good across those locales. And then now we're just kind of developing and then going to be ready for harvest as you go into the late spring period. And certainly that crop, although they've had some minor problems here or there, overall pretty good conditions across that area.
Anything else you're keeping an eye on around the world that we need to know about?
No, that's pretty much the bulk of it, Todd.
Okay, thanks much, John.
You're welcome.
John Davis is with Chesapeake Energy. He's in Chicago, Illinois, and somebody from that office, they're up on the 23rd floor of the Boeing building, joins us each and every Monday afternoon here on the Closing Market Report to take a look at the agricultural weather forecast. We'll say so long now to some of our radio stations. For the rest of you, the farming world is coming up. We'll talk with Rob Elliott today. He's with the National Corn Growers Association.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we'll talk with Rob Elliott. He's an immediate past president of the Illinois Corn Growers Association, hails from a farm near Monmouth, Illinois, and he's a current member of the National Corn Growers Association's Ethanol Committee. Thanks for taking time out of your busy spring schedule, Rob. We do appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure to get the opportunity, Todd.
Tell me first about your farm there in Monmouth.
I farm with my brothers, my uncle, my dad in the Monmouth, Illinois, Warren County area, corn, soybeans, and we have a joint venture between all of us here.
And you've been involved in the corn growers for quite some time, I suppose, since you are an immediate past president of the Illinois Corn Growers Association. How long have you been involved?
I have been about 8 years on the Corn Growers Board, something like that, and served last year as president.
Tell me about your position with the Ethanol Committee at NCGA.
Well, NCGA divvies up individual state association folks into various action teams or committees, and the one that I happen to be on is the Ethanol Committee, which is made up of a group of about 15 from across the country and is chaired by a gentleman from Nebraska, and the staff leadership assigned to that is Jamie Klein from St. Louis.
Yeah, tell me about an action committee and what they're supposed to do, and then we'll get into the ethanol committee itself.
Sure. I mean, various aspects of priorities for NCGA. So how do you take positions of, you know, current topics in the market that you're unique to that committee? It could be trade. It could be ethanol. It could be research and development, those kinds of things. And they would deal with the different aspects of policy affecting those, as well as would have a budget for each of those committees that would deal with reports and research and those kinds of things.
Now, I'll take time here to read the National Corn Growers Position Paper, or part of it, on ethanol. And the backgrounder, which is probably the most important part to begin with, says that NCGA believes it is in the best interest of the U.S. consumer to have a comprehensive national energy plan which includes renewable fuels. Why is that the case?
Well, certainly with our reliance on foreign oil the way it is today, with 60-70% of what we bring into this country from a lot of areas of the world that don't like us very well, energy security is certainly a big thing. And certainly the renewable aspect of ethanol being made from renewable energy from corn in this particular case, certainly good for the environment as well as good for the rural economies out there. With the advent of the ethanol industry growth in rural America, it's been a significant driver to upgrade those local economies.
What are the things that you're working with Congress and the administration on at this point to promote the use of ethanol?
Well, currently, probably the biggest topics right now would be two or three different ones. But one would be the E15 waiver, which would allow increasing from an E10 blend up to an E15% blend of ethanol into gasoline. Doesn't require that, but it would allow that. And part of the reasoning behind that is currently the renewable fuel standard for 2010 is requiring 12 billion gallons. We produce in this country about 12 billion gallons, or that's approaching 10% of the available gasoline. So we've quickly approached what's called a blend wall. So the ability to put a higher blend will rapidly help the profitability of the industry. The second two things would be what's called the renewable of the volumetric ethanol excise tax credit, which is a credit goes back to the blender of record for ethanol. And the other part of that would be a secondary tariff on imported ethanol. Those are set to expire in December of 2010. they're currently in the House and in the Senate are bills to extend those for five more years. Those would both be critical to the financial future of the ethanol industry and rural America again as well.
The 15% blend rate is fairly easy to understand, and I think we can skip over that. But maybe the excise tax, you might explain just a bit how that would work and what it does at this point and why you're talking to Congress about it.
Okay, so currently there's a 45 cent, it's a tax credit. So if the blender of record, be that an oil company or a fuel distributor, whoever is blending the ethanol into that gallon of gasoline, would get a 45 cent credit. That credit was meant to make a lucrative situation in buying ethanol fuel, as well as help with infrastructure improvements to be able to handle ethanol at a wider piece of that fuel distribution network. So 54 cents, which has a very good financial impact on the industry, would go to that blender of record. The other piece, the secondary tariff, is a 54-cent tariff that is placed on imported ethanol. And really the reason for that is to create a credit offset so that that ethanol tax credit is not applied to foreign producers of ethanol that would be imported into the country. So don't use federal tax dollars on imported sources of ethanol.
Why is it that, let me back this up. When is it that you think that the ethanol industry might be able to sustain itself without tax credits, or does it need to do that based on what Congress has done and the country does for the gasoline or oil producers of this world?
Well, so really, the ethanol industry is still a fledgling industry, actually. And it's only been that the growth has occurred basically in the last 5 years. So it's an industry that's been around for a while, but the extent or volume of it that it's reached today has only been here in the last 4 or 5 years. So certainly the ability to establish itself in the marketplace is still ongoing. The ability to sell that fuel and get consumers used to buying it and being comfortable with it is still ongoing. So a bit, it's still a fledgling industry. The other part of that is it's really on the cusp of profitability. So working on a very slim margin today. Some days they're making money, some days they aren't. If that credit, which gives some push for demand, goes away, it could put this industry on the wrong side of that margin equation, which results in loss of income, results in loss of other tax revenues, results in loss of jobs and, a negative impact to rural economies. So right now, probably doesn't make sense to take it away.
When you talk to congressmen and women, do they ask you, and I'm going to take a different run at ethanol, do they ask you very much about the food versus fuel debate?
I think a couple years ago that was a hot topic, and that was oil companies and the Grocery Manufacturers Association and the like had promoted that, and we were at a perfect storm in the economy right then, where oil prices were extremely high, driving costs of goods up across the country, which elevated the price of corn, and we had low crops in many parts of the world. So they were trying to put that on the back of ethanol, but in reality, it was actually, energy costs that were driving that. I think since that point in time, it's subsided, and people realized that ethanol wasn't the driver for those food price increases. It was more to do with energy costs and market speculation than it ever was about ethanol causing that rise. Since that point in time, food prices have been slow to come down, and corn prices have been cut in half and rapidly come down. So it's pretty clear that food versus fuel was not very, very sound in its background.
Did your committee and the National Corn Growers Association believe that all feedstocks into the ethanol industry, whether they be from corn or other sources, stover, cellulosic of some sort, miscanthus, if that ever comes into being, should be subject to the same types of tax breaks that ethanol made from corn is?
You know, we're in an era where we need to be supportive of any type of fuels that are renewable, that get us away from that addiction to foreign oil. And, you know, one of the basic premises of this whole thing is energy security. Why do we want to continue to fund that, in many cases, that terrorist war chest that can come back to haunt us? And renewable fuels of any kind, be it cellulose, be it corn, be it biodiesel, any of those certainly are worthy of investment from us as a country as alternatives to how we spend money otherwise. So certainly they tend to make extreme sense for us from an energy security standpoint.
Tell me about e-diesel and what kind of work your committee has been doing with that particular product. Rather than gasoline mixed with ethanol, this would be a diesel fuel blend.
You're speaking of biodiesel or ethanol blended into diesel?
Ethanol, e-diesel.
Okay. E-diesel has been, there has been some of that. It's been a little slower to take shape based on, you know, a variety of things. So a little bit slower to grab a presence in the marketplace.
Is it a product that probably you're not going to push too much anymore?
I'm not sure where that's going to land. I know there's been there's ongoing testing going on with motors and fuel injection systems and the like, but I'm just not really versed well enough in where that's ultimately going to land. I think the jury's still out.
I was reading in an older version of the committee's paperwork that at one point it would have liked for the industry, the fuel industry, to support E85 in a kind of a unique way, such that when cars that would roll off the line that were capable of burning E85 or a variation of ethanol and gasoline blends, that they be filled with E85 coming off the line, and that there be paperwork included in those that would promote the locations of E85 pumps. Have you gotten anywhere in that area?
Well, that aspect of having E85 in the tank when it gets ultimately in the customer's hands, I don't believe has happened. But what has happened is each of the big three domestic automakers between Ford, GM, and Chrysler have committed to the industry. In fact, we spent time in Washington, D.C. in March with the auto folks that by 2012, half of their volume of the cars that they sell would be E85 or flex fuel compatible. So we're making progress. They're making progress as well with infrastructure. One of the areas that has been a big focus is with blender pumps that could ultimately make an E10, E15, E30 to E85 blend right on the spot. So I think you'll see more and more blender pumps at fueling stations in the future as well.
This afternoon, we're talking with Rob Elliott. He's the immediate past president of the Illinois Corn Growers Association, a current member of the National Corn Growers Association Ethanol Committee. You're listening to The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. More in a moment.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
It's National Crepe Suzette Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1833, Illinois blacksmith John Deere developed the first cast steel plow. Deere's plow was made of wrought iron and had a steel share that could cut through sticky soil without clogging. Deere's first steel plow sale was to a local farmer named Lewis Crandall. It wasn't long, though, before the plow was in huge demand. By 1855, John Deere's factory was selling over 10,000 steel plows a year. The steel plow made Deere a millionaire. In 1851, John Gorey patented an ice-making machine, the first U.S. patent for a mechanical refrigerator. Although the mechanism produced ice in quantities, leakage and irregular performance sometimes impaired its operation. Gorey is considered by many the father of refrigeration and air conditioning. And in 1898, Daniel Gerber of baby food fame was born. But it was actually his wife, Dorothy, that was the genius behind prepared baby food. In 1927, she encouraged her husband to hand strain solid food for her 7-month-old daughter, Sally. After several evenings, Dorothy suggested to her husband that the work could easily be accomplished at the Gerber family's Fremont Canning Company. The rest is history. A year later, in 1928, strained peas, prunes, carrots, spinach, and beef vegetable soup were ready for the national market. And that's This Day in Agricultural History.
This is The Farming World. It's a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Rob Elliott is on the line with us. He's a member of the National Corn Growers Association's Ethanol Committee. When we last spoke with him, he had just brought up the subject of blender pumps. Tell me what a blender pump is and where the idea came from, Mr. Elliott.
Well, virtually a blender pump would eliminate the need for multiple tanks underground at a fuel station. You could have a source of ethanol in one tank, a source of gasoline in another, and you could pick at the pump whether you want E10 or E15 or E30 or E85 that you want to put into your tank that day. So it would do on-the-spot blending right there and would make the tank situation underground much more simple than what we've known it in the past.
Simple underground, but it sounds rather complicated for the consumer when you'll come into that.
Once that consumer has an E85 vehicle, he can then pick, and much of that would probably obviously be dependent on price. Currently, ethanol is approaching a dollar under wholesale gasoline. So if you've got a flex fuel vehicle and you can use E85, certainly E85 is a significant buy relative to the other grades. Things peak and valley and change in cycle with gas and corn and ethanol, all of them. So that would change over time, and you could pick that blend that was right for you and right financially with the price tag per gallon on it. So we feel like as the consumer becomes more savvy and understands this thing better, that they'll be much more accepting of using those different blends.
Are there other places on the planet where consumers have this kind of choice at the pump?
They're scattered across the country, and typically, in the Midwest for the most part. So there have been states promoting, like South Dakota. We've got some beginning to come on the scene in Illinois. So certainly it's becoming the wave as people replace pumps that are, have outlived their useful life. The blender pump has become the product of choice as we move towards more ethanol blends.
What's their incentive to put in this pump beyond what's happening underneath the ground and the ability to mix at different sorts of percentages?
Well, as we get more and more flex fuel vehicles out there, you've got more people becoming aware of the need. If all the automakers domestically, and we maybe even push some of the guys from offshore to have more flex fuel vehicles, you've created demand that way. So you've got a consumer-driven piece of it. But at the same time, there are incentives out there on a state-by-state basis that would provide financial perks to those stations if they put in those blender pumps.
If the committee were able to ask Congress and receive from it everything it would like, what would be on that list?
Well, as we've mentioned, that E15 waiver certainly would be one, and that's going to be an EPA decision hopefully this summer.
Mm-hmm.
Again, as well, this the VTEC or volumetric ethanol excise tax credit as well as the secondary tariff, the extension for 5 years, would be the keys. And I think past that, what we need in the country is for our government and industry to give ethanol a positive from a standpoint of saying, we support this. The industry will remain strong because of that support, which will then drive the financial piece of the market to have confidence as we move to generation two of ethanol, which would be from things like corn fiber in the kernel, corn stover, corn cobs, miscanthus, as you mentioned earlier, or wood chips or other areas that we could get cellulosic ethanol from. So that next wave won't happen if the financial community isn't confident that this corn ethanol sector will continue to be successful.
You know, can we take up the second generation fuels just a bit at this
sure.
point? Beyond the development of the technology to ferment the fuel, what does the Ethanol Committee think are the primary problems with creating the second generation fuel? Is it the distribution, or not the distribution, but the collection, for instance, of these large amounts of cellulosic mass, if that is the case, for instance, from corn stover or miscanthus, or is it something else?
Well, I think the first thing is just the financial investment in getting to a, let's say, a dollar per gallon structure that can be affordable and workable. That's the key. The logistics and all those kind of things, albeit they can have some problematic nature to them, those can all be solved. So what we need first is get the process down that will make a solid financial impact on that conversion. That'll be the key to driving all the other pieces to hook onto it. So we'll develop the infrastructure, we'll develop the logistics if we can make the conversion process work correctly and financially soundly.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us today. How's work on your farm going this spring?
Spring has progressed very well. I mean, corn planting probably happened rather rapidly. We've been in a couple of kind of wet rain delays over our way. But certainly looks like we're off to a pretty good start for a crop year.
Mr. Elliott, thanks so much.
Hey, thank you for the opportunity.
You're very welcome. Rob Elliott is the immediate past president of the Illinois Corn Growers Association and current member of the National Corn Growers Association's Ethanol Committee. Joined us here on The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You have a good day.